Welcome to Animals Today, your home for serious talk about animals. I'm Dr. Lori Kirshner. You may have heard that recently off the coast of Peru, a large die-off of dolphins and porpoises occurred. Now, these events are always tragic and often mysterious. What caused this stranding? In a moment, Hardy Jones from BlueVoice.org will be joining us to describe what he saw and to discuss all sorts of dolphin-related issues. Later in the hour, why would someone want to paint 5,500 shelter dogs? And why would you want to buy one of these paintings? It's a really great story of dedication and determination for a very important cause, so stay with us. Now, I want to welcome Hardy Jones, Executive Director at BlueVoice.org and a Huffington Post contributor. He is well known for his long career as a conservation filmmaker. His new book is now out and is entitled Voice of Dolphins. Welcome, Hardy, and congratulations on the book.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Hardy, you contacted me to inform me about the multitude of dolphins and porpoises washing up onto the beaches of Peru, stranded, dead, or dying. How did you become aware of the incident?
Well, there was in February, there was a brief flurry of interest in the fact that there were a couple of hundred dolphins that were reported to have died on the coast of Peru. But then officials in the government kind of denied it, and some people down there denied it, and it just kind of slipped off of the pages, I guess off the radar of everybody. And then in late March, I received an email from a fellow in Peru, a marine mammal rescue expert, Dr. Carlos Yaipenyanos, and he said that he had solid news, solid information, that at least 1,000 dolphins were dead. But at that time, no one had actually gone onto the beaches where the dolphins had stranded. And by the way, when I use the term stranded, it means they're dead.
Mm. So you went down to the site, Hardy. Describe what you observed.
Well, I flew to Lima, and I met Carlos Yaipenyanos, whom I'm going to call Carlos from now on, if you don't mind.
Okay,
He's a veterinary doctor and an extraordinary individual. We went up to Chiclayo in north-central Peru, and then we got a four-wheel drive vehicle, and we went out onto the beach, which nobody had yet done. People were speculating. There were fishermen's reports. There were little dribbles of information here and there, but nobody had actually gone the length of the beach where this is supposed to have occurred. So we went up driving with one wheel in the surf and the other on the sand off along this very narrow beach, and we started counting dead dolphins. And by the time we were forced off the beach after running 85 miles, we had counted 615 dead dolphins, which is pretty horrifying, because I've worked with dolphins in the wild for more than 30 years, and I have a very keen appreciation for how wonderful they are and how intelligent and what kind of tragedy this really amounts to.
It sure is. Hardy, what killed these dolphins and porpoises?
Well, that's a difficult thing to say, but not impossible. I can tell you that there's two lines of investigation that have gone on this. One is the official Peruvian government, which is somewhat questionable. I don't want to be unfair, but it's governments can always be questioned because they have interests. And there's a very big fishing industry in Peru and an oil industry in Peru, which put a lot of pressure on the government for one reason, for various results. The independent investigation done by Carlos from the group that is called ORCA actually comes from having been on the beach, having done the necropsies on the beach, brought samples back to Lima. In other words, what I'm saying is that Carlos Yaipenyanos has been there, and he has done necropsies, and he has hard information, and he's an expert. The other people are speculating and kind of trying to dribble the ball in one direction or another, usually away from their favorite industry. Okay, so you asked me what it was that has killed them.
Yeah.
I had to give you that preface, though.
No, I'm glad you did. It really laid it out nicely.
So, what Carlos came up with from the samples that he took from the dolphins, and it's a heartbreaking thing to watch a necropsy take place on an animal that's just died, particularly a baby dolphin, but it had to be done. He did it, and one thing he ruled out was disease. He ruled out viral diseases, and he mm-hmm. ruled out bacteriological diseases. There were no indications of disease in those animals. Mm. He also ruled out the starvation. They were all in very, very good health prior to whatever impacted them. Also ruled out red tide, which can kill a lot of dolphins, but it normally kills a bunch of other species. So this is confined to two dolphin species. And so there you're starting to rule out a great many of the causes that have been implicated in other mass mortality events. Now, what's left? Well, Carlos found out that by doing these autopsies that the periotic bones in the ear, the inner ear bones, the very fragile bones in the ear had been broken, had been damaged. And he then found that there were bubbles in the tissues of the dolphins that were stranded. And I was there when he cut into the liver of one of the dolphins, and I saw bubbles just frothing out. And so the conclusion that he has come to has been that the deaths were due to acoustical trauma leading to rapid decompression syndrome. In other words, the hypothesis is that the dolphins were at depth and that a loud noise caused them pain and essentially a blinding of their sonar capabilities. They went for the surface rapidly, and this caused the onset of decompression sickness, which
wow.
manifested as bubbles, very large bubbles in some cases.
Wow. So what's next?
Pardon me?
What's next?
What's next? Well, we're gathering more data on, okay, so who's the culprit? Who produced the sounds?
Mm-hmm.
I have to be very careful and say that there is, at this point, no proof of the source of the sounds, but there is a logic to the imputation that it was seismic testing for oil that occurred over a period of months that coincided with the dolphin die-off, and in an area close to where the dolphins died. But I caution that there are some experts who have said that this is not that they're not on board with this diagnosis, but they can't come up with anything else. Just because they can't come up with anything else, excuse me, does not mean, just because they can't come up with something else does not mean that they, that means that the oil companies were involved in this. But it's hard to find another source for that sound. I'm checking with the U.S. Navy, but the U.S. Navy would not be operating off of the coast of Peru for 4 months. So
mm-hmm.
It's logic that's and process of elimination that is indicating this. It's not hard proof. And I'm sure that the Peruvian government and other experts are going to take a different point of view on this.
You're listening to Animals Today. We've got to take a quick break. We're talking to Hardy Jones. He's executive director at bluevoice.org. Don't go away. Welcome back to the program. We're talking to Hardy Jones from BlueVoice.org. And before the break, we're talking about the large die-off of dolphins and porpoises that occurred off the coast of Peru. What a tragic story. Hardy, how common or rare are these mass die-offs?
Unfortunately, they're not as uncommon as they used to be. I covered and wrote about in my book, The Voice of the Dolphins, I wrote extensively about a die-off that took place in the United States along the eastern seaboard back in the late 1980s. Dolphins, bottlenose dolphins in this case, began dying in New Jersey in March, and they died all the way along the coast down to Cape Canaveral, and the event ended in December of the following year. 600 or more dolphins came ashore dead, and many more were lost at sea. Now, there's one taking place in the Gulf of Mexico right now, which is almost certainly due to the oil spill. So these events are not so uncommon. They have different causes. In some cases, they are, in fact, diseases. There was a distemper, morbillivirus that took out half of the seals in northern Europe back about 20 years ago. So it can be various causes, and this one does not appear to be disease. But what is what's so dangerous in the oceans today, and the point that I really want to make, is that the chemicals which are getting into the ocean ecosystem, which are called persistent organic pollutants, or POPs, plus heavy metals such as mercury and cadmium, are building up in the food chain. They bioaccumulate or biomagnify so that a small amount of these chemicals can go into can be concentrated in the water. But then when plankton eat them and little fish eat the plankton and bigger fish eat and so forth up the food chain, they get concentrated by factors of many thousands. So dolphins have these large quantities of these chemicals in them. They are immunosuppressive. They also are estrogen imitators, which means that a mammal that has these chemicals in their body system is effectively ingesting something that acts the way estrogen does. And so this is a worldwide event and something we need to be very aware of, and something we need to take action to reverse.
Because it obviously affects human health, correct?
It does affect human health, and I'm an example of it. I was diagnosed with chronic mercury poisoning back in the late 90s, and then I was mm-hmm. diagnosed with a disease called multiple myeloma, which is a blood cancer, in 2003. And myeloma is associated with contaminants. It's associated with Agent Orange, the chemical that was used in Vietnam. And so I went after I had had this diagnosis, and I had my blood tested for these chemicals, and I was very high in a half dozen chemicals, such as PCBs, PBDEs, hexachlorobenzene, DDE, and others that you just don't want to have. And I really have to wonder where I got it. But I was eating a large amount of seafood at the time, particularly large seafood such as tuna and swordfish. And they are the ones that carry the largest quantities of both the heavy metals and the pops.
Do you still eat fish?
I eat small fish. Fish are good for you. There's no question about that. The omega-3s are very important in human health. But what I do is I check my fish out very carefully so that I will eat wild-caught Alaska salmon. I will not eat anything that has been farmed. So, yes, I eat it. I try and eat smaller fish. I'm one of those type that like anchovies, and my wife doesn't at all. But if you're eating smaller fish, you're getting much less concentration.
Many of our listeners simply do not eat any animal products. They are vegan. You would agree that eating a plant-based diet would probably be the most certain way of decreasing one's exposure to these toxins, not to mention be nice to the fish.
Yes, as long as the plants hadn't been sprayed, hadn't accumulated these things on their surface. But generally what you're saying is absolutely true, because these chemicals, the what I've called the POPs, organic pollutants, the persistent organic pollutants, they are lipophilic, which means that they concentrate in fat. So fish are not the only avenue through which you can ingest these chemicals. It can come in butter, in cheese, in the fat, in beef. So yes, right. I would say that a vegan or vegetarian diet with less fat is definitely beneficial.
You know, Hardy, recently there's been a lot of interest in protecting dolphins from needless slaughter. The award-winning film The Cove and Rick O'Berry's film Blood Dolphins. Now, decades ago, you filmed dolphin slaughter in Japan as well. Describe what you filmed and the effect of publicizing the practice.
Well, when I was a lot younger, in the late 1970s, I learned about the slaughter of dolphins in a place called Iki, Japan. And I had just started my filming career on dolphins and had met a very friendly and wonderful school. And so my sense of knowing them as individuals, as sentient creatures, fellow creatures, compelled me to take action on that. So I got together a crew, film crew, and we went over to Japan, and we landed right in the middle of the most ghastly massacre of dolphins. And the film that we took, I had been working for CBS News up until just a little bit before this. We took the film off the island up to the CBS Bureau in Tokyo, processed it, and sent it out over satellite. And it went around the world and caused a tremendous uproar, a real tsunami of protest. And that led to the closing of many of the dolphin hunting villages. There was just such bad publicity for Japan that some of the villages just got out of the business, and some of them were de-permitted, told they couldn't catch dolphins again.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break. This is Dr. Lori Kirshner. You're listening to Animals Today. We're speaking to Hardy Jones. The book is Voice of Dolphins. His website is bluevoice.org. The film is Dolphin. And stay with us, because later in the hour, we're going to learn why an artist is painting shelter dogs and the wonderful work he's going to be doing for homeless animals. Every little swallow, every chickadee, every little bird in the tall oak tree.
Nashville cats play green as country water.
Welcome back to the show. We're talking to Hardy Jones about dolphin slaughter, which, by the way, is still occurring elsewhere in Japan. So, Hardy, tell my listeners, what can they do to help end dolphin slaughter?
What I would urge them to do is to go to www.bluevoice.org, and there's an entire menu of things that are related to protecting dolphins and whales. One of the things that we're focused on right now is we are enumerating the diseases which occur in people who eat dolphin meat. They get high levels of mercury. It's been connected to diabetes and other diseases. So rather than telling people, don't do this, we're going to put you all over the newspapers, we're saying to them, for your own health and the health of your children and family, do not eat dolphin meat. It is extremely unhealthy.
That is incredible, what you're telling us. This is Dr. Lori Kirschner. You're listening to Animals Today. We're speaking to Hardy Jones.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
We are now pleased to welcome Marina Dervon. Her and her partner, Mark Baroni, are involved in an extraordinary project called An Active Dog. Welcome to the show, Marina.
Hi. Thank you very much for having me.
Marina, this project is called An Active Dog, and Mark and you have begun your huge project of making thousands of original paintings. Describe An Active Dog to us.
Okay, An Active Dog, what it is, it's actually one man, and that one man is Mark Baroni, who will be taking 2 years of his life to paint 5,500 shelter dogs, which represents approximately the number that are killed every day in the U.S. shelters.
And where did this idea come
from? For social change, and the idea of the project is to create a platform for the no-kill movement and to raise money and $20 million and a lot of awareness to the problem and why the no-kill equation is an effective solution.
And what made you guys decide to do this?
Well, actually, we were online trying to find a dog to adopt, and instead of finding a dog, we found out all the ways in which our shelter system is pretty archaic and killing close to 5 million animals every year, and we were just really overwhelmed and saddened and outraged and all of the above, and we really just simply asked ourselves, what could we do? Well, how can we use our talents to do something to help this? And it seemed easier at the time to do nothing because we felt powerless until we realized that it was the animals that are actually powerless, and we wanted to somehow be a voice, and we felt that art is a very powerful way of making a statement.
So are any of your paintings for sale now?
But yes, they are. We just started the capital campaign where people can actually, when they purchase a painting, the paintings stay in the exhibit. They become the owner, and obviously they get promoted, whether it's a company or a philanthropist. But all that money goes into the account that's not touched. It's building that $20 million. We don't get anything for what we're doing. We're doing it purely as a philanthropic gesture on our part.
That's so wonderful. So your goal is to raise $20 million to help create a no-kill nation, correct?
Yeah, the $20 million is really it's really not a lot of money. But the most important point, aside from the money, which is really there to help the rescue groups, the fosters, rehabilitation programs, however we can help them, because currently there is no dependable source of funds for the no-kill shelters, and we wanted to give them that because they're the ones saving the lives. And in addition to that, we really wanted to put this spotlight on the problem, because currently it's candy wrapped, and that's what we discovered, because we were as ignorant as the next person as to what was going on and how our tax dollars are being used to operate kill shelters when they could be used to operate no-kill shelters and actually recover costs. So, it makes sense ethically and economically to be no-kill. It makes no sense to do it the other way.
Right, that's correct. And, Marina, you mentioned that these paintings are displayed at an exhibit. Where is this exhibit?
We're in production. So we're in the two-year production phase, and he's already at 2,000 paintings. They're individual portraits, and these dogs have already been killed. So it's like it's a memorial. Obviously, in the paintings, they're alive. They're really beautiful. We have cities that we're talking to now that are interested in housing it as a permanent museum memorial. So it would be housed. It would be a tourist attraction. and it could continue beyond 20 million to raise a dependable ongoing source of funds for the shelters.
And these animals depicted in the paintings are actually animals that have been euthanized. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, they have already. That 5,500 have already gone. They're already They're already in heaven, wherever they go, depending upon your point of view.
And how do you know which particular animals are euthanized, which to paint?
It's very difficult, you know. I mean, like today, I literally before this call, I was having to print up and I had to pick out another 80 dogs, and it's heartbreaking. Because if you look at them, there's nothing wrong with them. They're they're totally healthy, adoptable animals, and yet we just see that they were needlessly killed. So it's pretty difficult. So I try to pick out a variety. So it really shows that in shelters, it's not just one kind of dog in there. They're all in there. Of every breed, every kind is in there. So that's really what we're trying to do.
And Marina, will cats or other animals benefit from an active dog?
Yeah, the actual project, you know, Mark just chose to do one animal because, you know, as I'm sure you know, there are so many more cats that are killed, and we'd be here for like 6 years painting. So, but all of the money that is raised and the awareness is for all of these animals. It's to save all the, you know, any animal that's in a shelter, whether it's a rabbit or a cat or a dog or whatever else is in there, it's to save them all because they need to be saved.
Tell us your website so people can look at these beautiful paintings that are displayed there.
Yeah, thank you. It's anactofdog.org. And, you know, people can, you know, obviously people that can afford it, purchase a painting and donate towards the fund. People can sponsor a painting, and that helps actually create the exhibit. So there are many ways. Lots of people want to be part of it, and so we try to create as many ways as possible for people to be part.
Right. Now, I noticed the lowest price is about $3,500 for a painting, certainly out of reach for many lovers of dogs. But as you mentioned, there's other ways people can support your wonderful efforts just by donating, correct?
Yeah. People can sponsor a painting for as little as $25, you know, up to $100, whatever they can afford. And then we have people that, you know, companies or individual philanthropists that want to buy a painting, but they may not have that money up front. So then there's payment plans. So people can do that too. And so we have people on that as well that pay like quarterly amounts to the fund.
Marina, how does one manage $20 million and at what point do the funds become available?
Obviously our vision right now is to, you know, get the capital campaign going and start, you know, getting that fund built. And then, you know, really working on the plan of how is it best distributed, you know, and having some kind of a system for that. So that would be the way that we would do it. And, you know, the idea was obviously if housed in its own museum, you've got merchandise. You've got so many more other ways to make money in addition to the people that will own a piece of the exhibit by paying, you know, for the painting. So there'll be many, many ways to make that money. And really, if you think about what the large animal charities make, which is over $100 million a year, this is just like less than 20%. And that's just for 1 year.
Yeah.
So it's not a lot. And most of the time when people donate, they don't see where their money goes. Ours is very clearly for the no-kill shelters only or no-kill endeavors. It's just a wonderful thing to support.
Marina, it's a wonderful thing. It's a wonderful project of dedication and determination for a very important cause. Marina Durbin, thank you very much for appearing on Animals Today.
Thank you so much for having me on, and we both look forward to speaking with you again, and we'll keep you updated on our progress.
Don't go away. Peter in the News next. You're listening to Animals Today.
Free me. Can't you hear? That's what I
Welcome back to Animals Today. Hi, Peter.
How you doing, Lori?
I'm just doing great. What a wonderful story, what we just heard, the act of dog.
Yes. And what a project.
Yes.
I don't know if you were able to see any of this. First of all, you really need to visit the website, and I would just encourage everyone to check out this project.
It just makes you want to cry just to look at the paintings.
Yeah. First of all, we didn't really get into it because he was not on the line, but the artist is a fabulous artist, and these paintings are very evocative, and when you realize that all these animals are gone, it's very powerful emotionally, even seeing them on your computer.
And these are individual animals
that are killed. That's right. They also show him on the YouTubes. He's got 20 portraits lined up and works on them sort of simultaneously with the photograph of each animal right above, and he just goes through them. And imagine what this might look like if they could really pull this off and get a city that they're negotiating with to actually want to house this as a destination.
Yeah.
Imagine having these 5,500 portraits of all these animals that are gone.
Yeah.
And how powerful that would be.
It just reminds people.
Yeah.
About the millions of animals we kill every year in our shelters.
Yeah.
It reminds them.
So it's a big idea and a big project,
yeah.
And we certainly wish them well. So everyone go visit them on the website.
Right, right.
And you'll see.
Yeah.
And even if you don't have $3,550 to buy a 12-inch square painting, you can still donate and you get some other little things.
Yeah.
So it's nice.
It's really wonderful.
Now, I want to tell you about tigers for a second here,
okay?
Because, you know, everyone wants to eat tiger parts or kill tigers, and the poaching continues to be a huge problem. And there is this global tiger recovery program, which involves tiger range countries, and they have recently had their second summit where they are trying to see how they're doing to double the number of free-roaming tigers in the area by 2022. And they recently met in New Delhi, and they are indeed making progress, and the tiger populations are starting to slowly come back. But indeed, as I mentioned earlier, poaching continues to be the main hindrance here.
Yeah.
And there is a large consumer demand for the parts and products, and that's really the main hindrance to making even greater progress. So it's really a sad sort of situation.
Yeah, it sure
but
is.
But finally, the governments are cooperating.
Yeah.
Now, in California, the foie gras ban is about to take effect.
Oh, that's right. In a month or two, right?
Yeah, July 1st.
Oh,
it
good.
Is now illegal to create, I think, or serve. This has been passed some time ago. In fact, it's almost 7 years ago, to give the restaurants and the businesses that create this product a chance to get out of town or adapt or go figure something else to do.
Just put it off their menu.
And there are a handful of chefs and restaurants who are making one final plea to continue the practice or to reverse the law. And it's a pretty sad effort. But they have created a thing called the Coalition for Humane and Ethical Farming Standards, which...
Oh, give me a break.
...is an acronym for CHEFS, or CHEFS is the acronym, or whatever. And they are trying to combat the perception that they don't care how animals are treated. So some of the restaurants are also having special
menus. Are they saying that you can create that dish...
Yeah.
In a humane way?
Yes, they are. They are saying that.
Okay, that's.
And they're also, but they also make the point that people are comfortable eating other sorts of animals too. So why are you picking on fatted, overfed geese?
Okay, well, that is a good point.
Yeah. Nonetheless, and they also claim that the geese are not, the product is not coming from cruelty. So that's sort of a
which
tough,
we know
tough.
Is not true.
Yes. But on the other hand, some of the activists, the chefs claim that some activists are going into their private lives, taking photographs of their children and posting other dangerous things online. They also claim that false restaurant reviews are being made on restaurant sites like Yelp if for the foie gras purveyors. So they are a little upset about that. In fact, there's a member of the chef, Andy Bourdain, that TV crazy guy. He, Anthony Bourdain, I think I said the wrong name. Anyway, he really is objecting to the photographs of the chef's children and said, every time a chef is threatened, someone should skin a panda. That's Anthony Bourdain.
Oh, great.
So this is the state of the argument right now.
Yeah.
So finally, in Maryland, the anti-pit bull rule has been passed. So it is now Maryland Appeals Court has declared that pit bulls and crossbred pit bulls are inherently dangerous. Okay? So that's going to create a heck of a chaotic situation in Maryland. If any part, if a dog is deemed to have any pit bull, then he or she is inherently dangerous, regardless of any other factor.
So are they trying to ban pit bulls from?
They've made this to change the legal status of these animals and the people who have them.
You know, that's really a shame.
Yeah.
It really is a shame. I mean, one of our dogs is part pit bull.
Yeah.
Couldn't be sweeter.
Right.
And really, they get a bad rap.
And in the state of Ohio, where similar legislation had been passed and then unpassed, it increased insurance rates, and they really couldn't even enforce it. It was ineffective and inequitable. So this is going to be a mess. I'll keep you informed.
Thank you. Thank you, Peter.
You bet.
Great stuff, and thank you for listening to Animals Today. This is Dr. Lori Kirschner encouraging you to nurture your love and compassion for the only other beings sharing our planet, the animals.